outside the door, pushed under the gap at the bottom. Strike moved gingerly onto his hands and knees, and retrieved what he soon saw was a note from Robin. Dear Cormoran, he supposed there was no going back to Mr. Strike now. I read your list of points to investigate further at the front of the file. I thought I might be able to follow up the first two, Agumon and the Malmaison Hotel. I will be on my mobile if you would rather I came back to the office. I have set an alarm just outside your door for 2 p.m., so that you have enough time to get ready for your 5 p.m. appointment at 1 Arlington Place to interview Kiara Porter and Bryony Radford. There is water, paracetamol and Alka-Seltzer on the desk outside. Robin. P.S. Please don't be embarrassed about last night. You didn't say or do anything you should regret. He sat quite still on his camp bed for 5 minutes, holding the note, wondering whether he was about to throw up, but enjoying the warm sunshine on his back. Four paracetamol and a glass of Alka-Seltzer, which almost decided the vomiting question for him, were followed by 15 minutes in a dingy toilet, with results offensive to both nose and ear. But he was sustained throughout by a feeling of profound gratitude for Robin's absence. Back in the outer office, he drank 2 more bottles of water and turned off the alarm, which had set his throbbing brains rattling in his skull. After some deliberation, he chose a set of clean clothes, took shower gel, deodorant, razor, shaving cream and towel out of the kit bag, pulled a pair of swimming trunks out of the bottom of one of the cardboard boxes on the landing, extracted the pair of grey metal crutches from another, then limped down the metal stair with a sports bag over his shoulder and the crutches in his other hand. He bought himself a family-sized bar of dairy milk on the way to Mallet Street. Bernie Coleman, an acquaintance in the Army Medical Corps, had once explained to Strike how the majority of the symptoms associated with a crashing hangover were due to dehydration and hypoglycemia, which were the inevitable results of prolonged vomiting. Strike munched his way through the chocolate, crutches jammed under his arm, and every step jarring his head, which still felt as though it was being compressed by tight wires. But the laughing god of drunkenness had not yet forsaken him. Agreeably detached from reality and from his fellow human beings, he walked down the steps to the Yulu pool with an unfeigned sense of entitlement, and as usual, nobody challenged him, not even the only other occupant of the changing room, who, after one glance of arrested interest at the prosthesis Strike was unstrapping, kept his eyes politely averted. His false leg stuffed into a locker along with yesterday's clothes, and leaving the door open due to a lack of change, Strike moved towards the shower on crutches, his belly spilling over the top of his trunks. He noted, as he soaped himself, that the chocolate and paracetamol were beginning to take the edge off his nausea and pain. Now, for the first time, he walked out to the large pool. There were only 2 students in here, both in the fast lane and wearing goggles, oblivious to everything but their own prowess. Strike proceeded to the far side, set the crutches down carefully beside the steps, and slid into the slow lane. He was more unfit than he had ever been in his life. Ungainly and lopsided, he kept swimming into the side of the pool, but the cool, clean water was soothing to body and spirit. Panting, he completed a single length and rested there, his thick arms spread along the side of the pool, sharing the responsibility for his heavy body with the caressing water and gazing up at the high white ceiling. Little waves, outrunners sent by the young athletes on the other side of the pool, tickled his chest. The terrible pain in his head was receding into the distance. A fiery red light viewed through mist. The chlorine was sharp and clinical in his nostrils, but it no longer made him want to be sick. Deliberately, like a man ripping off a bandage on a congealing wound, Strike turned his attention to the thing he had attempted to drown in alcohol. Jago Ross. In every respect, the antithesis of Strike. Handsome in the manner of an Aryan prince, possessor of a trust fund, born to fulfill a preordained place in his family and the world, a man with all the confidence 12 generations of well-documented lineage can give. He had quit a succession of high-flying jobs, developed a persistent drinking problem, and was vicious in the manner of an overbred, badly disciplined animal. Charlotte and Ross belonged to that tight, interconnected network of public-schooled bluebloods who all knew each other's families, connected through generations of interbreeding and old-school ties. While the water lapped his thickly hairy chest, Strike seemed to see himself, Charlotte and Ross at a great distance, from the wrong end of a telescope, so that the arc of their story became clear. It mirrored Charlotte's restless day-to-day behaviour, that craving for heightened emotion that expressed itself most typically in destructiveness. She had secured Jago Ross as a prize when 18, the most extreme example she could find of his type and the very epitome of eligibility, as her parents had seen it. Perhaps that had been too easy, and certainly too expected, because she had then dumped him for Strike, who, for all his brains, was anathema to Charlotte's family, an uncategorizable mongrel. What was left, after all these years, to a woman who craved emotional storms, but to leave Strike again and again, until at last the only way to leave with real éclat was to move full circle back to the place where he had found her. Strike allowed his aching body to float in the water. The racing students were still thrashing their way up and down the fast lane. Strike knew Charlotte. She was waiting for him to rescue her. It was the final, cruelest test. He did not swim back down the pool, but hopped sideways through the water, using his arms to grip the long side of the pool, as he had done during physiotherapy in the hospital. The second shower was more pleasurable than the first. He made the water as hot as he could stand, lathered himself all over, then turned the dial to cold to rinse himself. The prosthesis reattached, he shaved over a sink with a towel tied around his waist, then dressed with unusual care. He had never worn the most expensive suit and shirt that he owned. They had been gifts from Charlotte on his last birthday, raiment suitable for her fiancé. He remembered her beaming at him as he stared at his unfamiliarly well-styled self in a full-length mirror. The suit and shirt had hung in their carry case ever since, because he and Charlotte had not gone out much after last November, because his birthday had been the last truly happy day they had spent together. Soon afterwards, the relationship had begun to stagger back into the old familiar grievances, into the same mire in which it had foundered before, but which, this time, they had sworn to avoid. He might have incinerated the suit. Instead, in a spirit of defiance, he chose to wear it, to strip it of its associations and render it mere pieces of cloth. The tailoring of the jacket made him look slimmer and fitter. He left the white shirt open at the throat. Strike had had a reputation, in the army, for being able to bounce back from excessive alcohol consumption with unusual speed. The man staring at him out of the small mirror was pale, with purple shadows under his eyes, yet in the sharp Italian suit he looked better than he had done in weeks. His black eye had vanished at last, and his scratches had healed. A cautiously light meal, copious amounts of water, another evacuatory trip to the restaurant bathroom, more painkillers, then, at 5 o'clock, a prompt arrival at number 1 Arlington Place. The door was answered, after his second knock, by a cross-looking woman in black-framed glasses and a short grey bob. She let him in with an appearance of reluctance, then walked briskly away across a stone-floored hall, which incorporated a magnificent staircase with a wrought-iron banister, calling, "Gee! Somebody strike!" There were rooms on both sides of the hall. To the left, a small knot of people, all of whom seemed to be dressed in black, were staring in the direction of some powerful light source that Strike could not see, but which illuminated their rapt faces. Semei appeared, striding through this door into the hall. He too was wearing glasses, which made him look older. His jeans were baggy and ripped, and his white T-shirt was emblazoned with an eye that appeared to be weeping glittering blood, which on closer examination proved to be red sequins.
"You'll have to wait," he said curtly. "Brian is busy and Kiara's going to be ours. You can park yourself in there if you want."
He pointed towards the right-hand room, where the edge of a tray-laden table was visible.
"Or you can stand around and watch like these useless fuckers," he went on, suddenly raising his voice and glaring at the huddle of elegant young men and women who were staring towards the light source.
They dispersed at once without protest, some of them crossing the hall into the room opposite.
"Better suit, by the way,"
Sumay added, with a flash of his old archness.
He marched back into the room from which he had come. Strike followed the designer and took up the space vacated by the roughly dispatched onlookers. The room was long and almost bare, but its ornate cornices, pale blank walls, and curtainless windows gave it an atmosphere of mournful grandeur. A further group of people, including a long-haired male photographer bent over his camera, stood between Strike and the scene at the far end of the room, which was dazzlingly illuminated by a series of arc lights and light screens. Here was an artful arrangement of tattered old chairs, one on its side, and three models. They were a breed apart, with faces and bodies in rare proportions that fell precisely between the categories of strange and impressive. Fine-boned and recklessly slim, they had been chosen, Strike assumed, for the dramatic contrast in their colouring and features. Sitting like Christine Keeler on a back-to-front chair, long legs splayed in spray-on-white leggings, but apparently naked from the waist up, was a black girl as dark-skinned as Sumay himself, with an afro and slanting, seductive eyes. Standing over her, in a white vest decorated in chains, which just covered her pubis, was a Eurasian beauty with flat black hair cut into an asymmetric fringe. To one side, leaning alone and sideways on the back of another chair, was Kiara Porter. Alabaster fair, with long baby blonde hair, wearing a white, semi-transparent jumpsuit through which her pale, pointed nipples were clearly visible. The makeup artist, almost as tall and thin as the models, was bending over the black girl, pressing a pad into the sides of her nose. The three models waited silently in position, still as portraits, all three faces blank and empty, waiting to be called to attention. The other people in the room, the photographer appeared to have two assistants. Sumay, now biting his fingernails on the sidelines, was accompanied by the cross-looking woman in glasses, all spoke in low mutters, as though frightened of disturbing some delicate equilibrium. At last the makeup artist joined Sumay, who talked inaudibly and rapidly to her, gesticulating. She stepped back into the bright light, and, without speaking to the model, ruffled and rearranged Kiara Porter's long mane of hair. Kiara showed no sign that she knew she was being touched, but waited in patient silence. Bryony retreated into the shadows once more, and asked Sumay something. He responded with a shrug, and gave her some inaudible instruction that had her look around until her eyes rested on Strike. They met at the foot of the magnificent staircase.
"Hi," she whispered. "Let's go through here."
She led him across the hall into the opposite room, which was slightly smaller than the first, and dominated by the large table covered with buffet-style food. Several long, wheeled clothing racks, jammed with sequined, ruffled, and feathered creations arranged, according to colour, stood in front of a marble fireplace. The displaced onlookers, all of them in their 20s, were gathered in here. Talking quietly, picking in desultory fashion at the half-empty platters of mozzarella and parma ham, and talking into, or playing with, their phones. Several of them subjected Strike to appraising looks, as he followed Bryony into a small back room, which had been turned into a makeshift makeup station. Two tables, with big portable mirrors, stood in front of the large single window, which looked out onto a spruce garden. The black plastic boxes standing around reminded Strike of those his Uncle Ted had taken fly-fishing, except that Bryony's drawers were crammed with coloured powders and paints. Tubes and brushes lay lined up on towels, spread across the tabletops. "Hi," she said in a normal voice.
"God,
Talk about cutting the tension with a knife, eh? Guy's always a perfectionist, but this is his first proper shoot since Lula died, so he's, you know, seriously uptight. She had dark, choppy hair. Her skin was sallow. Her features, though large, were attractive. She was wearing tight jeans on long, slightly bandy legs, a black vest, several fine gold chains around her neck, rings on her fingers and thumbs, and also what looked like black leather ballet shoes. This kind of footwear always had a slightly aphrodisiac effect on Strike, because it reminded him of the fold-up slippers his Aunt Joan used to carry in her handbag, and therefore of bunions and corns. Strike began to explain what he wanted from her, but she cut him off. "Guy's told me everything. Want a ciggy? We can smoke in here if we open this." So saying, she wrenched open the door that led directly onto a paved area of the garden. She made a small space on one of the cluttered makeup tables and perched herself on it. Strike took one of the vacated chairs and drew out his notebook. "Okay, fire away," she said. And then, without giving him time to speak, "I've been thinking about that afternoon non-stop ever since, actually. So, so sad."
"Did you know Lula well?" asked Strike.
"Yeah, pretty well. I'd done her makeup for a couple of shoots, made her up for the rainforest benefit. When I told her I can thread eyebrows..."
"You can what?"
"Thread eyebrows. It's like plucking, but with threads." Strike could not imagine how this worked.
"Right."
"She asked me to do them for her at home. The paps were all over her, all the time, even if she was going to the salon. It was insane. So I helped her out." She had a habit of tossing back her head to flick her overlong fringe out of her eyes, and a slightly breathy manner. Now she threw her hair over to one side, raked it with her fingers, and peered at him through her fringe. "I got there about 3. She and Kiara were all excited about D.B. Mack arriving. Girly gossip, you know. I'd never have guessed what was coming. Never."
"Lula was excited, was she?"
"Oh, God, yeah. What do you think? How would you feel if someone had written songs about..." "Well," she said, with a breathy little laugh, "maybe it's a girl thing. He's so charismatic. Kiara and I were having a laugh about it while I did Lula's eyebrows. Then Kiara asked me to do her nails. I ended up making them both up as well, so I was there for must have been 3 hours. Yeah, I left about 6.
"So you'd describe Lula's mood as excited, would you?"
"Yeah. Well, you know, she was a bit distracted. She kept checking her phone. It was lying in her lap while I was doing her eyebrows. I knew what that meant. Evan was messing her around again."
"Did she say that?"
"No, but I knew she was really pissed off at him. Why do you think she said that to Kiara about her brother, about leaving him everything?"
This seemed a stretch to Strike. "Did you hear her say that, too?"
"What? No. But I heard about it. I mean, afterwards. Kiara told us all. I think I was in the loo when she actually said it. Anyway, I totally believe it. Totally."
"Why is that?"
She looked confused. "Well, she really loved her brother, didn't she? God, that was always obvious. He was probably the only person she could really rely on. Months before, around the time she and Evan split up the first time, I was making her up for the Stella show, and she was telling everyone her brother was really pissing her off, going on and on about what a freeloader Evan was. And, you know, Evan was jacking her around again that last afternoon, so she was thinking that James, is it James, had had him right all along. She always knew he had her interest at heart, even if he was a bit bossy sometimes. This is a really, really exploitative business, you know. Everyone's got an agenda."
"Who do you think had an agenda for Lula?"
"Oh my God, everyone," said Bryony,
making a wide sweeping gesture with a cigarette-holding hand, which encompassed all of the inhabited rooms outside.
"She was the hottest model out there. Everyone wanted a piece of her. I mean, Guy."
But Bryony broke off.
"Well, Guy's a businessman, but he did adore her. He wanted her to go and live with him after that stalker business. He's still not right about her dying. I heard he tried to contact her through some spiritualist. Margot Leiter told me. He's still devastated. He can barely hear her name without crying.
Anyway, said Bryony, that's all I know.
I never dreamed that afternoon would be the last time I saw her. I mean, my God.
Did she talk about Duffield at all while you were, threading her eyebrows?
No,
said Bryony. But she wouldn't, would she, if he was really hacking her off?
So, as far as you can remember, she mainly spoke about D.B. Mack.
Well, it was more Kiara and me talking about him.
But you think she was excited to meet him?
Oh, God, yes, of course.
Tell me, did you see a blue piece of paper with Lula's handwriting on it when you were in the flat?
Bryony shook her hair over her face again and combed it with her fingers.
What?
No. No, I didn't see anything like that. Why, what was it?
I don't know, said Strike. That's what I'd like to find out.
No, I didn't see it. Blue, did you say? No.
Did you see any paper at all with her writing on it?
No, I can't remember any papers. No.
She shook her hair out of her face.
I mean, something like that could have been lying around, but I wouldn't have necessarily noticed it.
The room was dingy. Perhaps he only imagined that she had changed colour. But he had not invented the way she twisted her right foot up onto her knee and examined the sole of the leather ballet slipper for something that was not there.
Lula's driver, Kieran Colovers-Jones.
Oh, that really, really cute guy, said Bryony. We used to tease her about Kieran. He had such a gigantic crush on her. I think Kiara uses him now sometimes.
Bryony gave a meaningful little giggle.
She's got a bit of a rep as a good-time girl, Kiara. I mean, you can't help liking her, but...
Colovers-Jones says that Lula was writing something on blue paper in the back of his car when she left her mother's that day.
Have you talked to Lula's mother yet? She's a bit weird.
And I'd like to find out what it was.
Bryony flicked her cigarette stub out of the open door and shifted restlessly on the desk.
It could have been anything.
He waited for the inevitable suggestion and was not disappointed.
A shopping list or something?
Yeah, it could have been. But if, for the sake of argument, it was a suicide note...
But it wasn't. I mean, that's silly. How could it have been? Who'd write a suicide note that far in advance, and then get their face done and go out dancing? That doesn't make any sense at all.
It doesn't seem likely, I agree. But it would be good to find out what it was.
Maybe it had nothing to do with her dying. Why couldn't it have been a letter to Evan or something, telling him how hacked off she was?
She doesn't seem to have become hacked off with him until later that day. Anyway, why would she write a letter when she had his telephone number and was going to see him that night?
Well, I don't know, said Bryony restlessly. I'm just saying it could have been something that doesn't make any difference.
And you're quite sure you didn't see it?
Yes, I'm quite sure, she said. Her colour definitely heightened. I was there to do a job, not go snooping around her stuff. Is that everything, then?
Yeah, I think that's all I've got to ask about that afternoon, said Strike. But you might be able to help me with something else. Do you know Tansy Bestigui?
No, said Bryony. Only her sister, Ursula. She's hired me a couple of times for big parties. She's awful.
In what way?
Just one of those spoiled rich women. Well, said Bryony with a twist to her mouth, she isn't nearly as rich as she'd like to be. Both those Chillingham sisters went for old men with bags of money. Wealth-seeking missiles, the pair of them. Ursula thought she'd hit the jackpot when she married Cyprian May, but he hasn't got nearly enough for her. She's knocking 40 now. The opportunities aren't there the way they used to be. I suppose that's why she hasn't been able to trade up. Then, evidently feeling that her tone needed some explanation, she continued, I'm sorry, but she accused me of listening to her bloody voicemail messages. The makeup artist folded her arms across her chest, glaring at Strike. I mean, please. She chucked me her mobile and told me to call her a cab, without so much as a bloody please or thank you. I'm dyslexic. I hit the wrong button, and the next thing I know, she's screaming her bloody head off at me.
Why do you think she was so upset?
because I heard a man she wasn't married to telling her he was lying in a hotel room fantasizing about going down on her, I expect," said Bryony coolly.
"So she might be trading up after all?" asked Strike.
"That's not up," said Bryony. But then she added hastily, "I mean, pretty tacky message. Anyway, listen, I've got to get back out there, or Guy will be going ballistic." He let her go. After she had left, he made two more pages of notes. Bryony Radford had shown herself a highly unreliable witness, suggestible and mendacious, but she had told him much more than she knew.
Chapter 7. The shoot lasted for another 3 hours. Strike waited in the garden, smoking and consuming more bottled water, while dusk fell. From time to time he wandered back into the building to check on progress, which seemed immensely slow. Occasionally he glimpsed or heard Sommet, whose temper seemed frayed, barking instructions at the photographer or one of the black-clad minions who flitted between clothes racks. Finally, at nearly 9 o'clock, after Strike had consumed a few slices of the pizza that had been ordered by the morose and exhausted stylist's assistant, Chiara Porter descended the stairs where she had been posing with her two colleagues, and joined Strike in the makeup room, which Bryony was busy stripping bare. Chiara was still wearing the stiff silver mini-dress in which she had posed for the last picture. Attenuated and angular, with milk-white skin, hair almost as fair, and pale blue eyes set very wide apart, she stretched out her endless legs in platform shoes that were tied with long silver threads up her calves, and lit a Marlboro light.
"God, I can't believe you're Roker's son," she said breathlessly, her chrysoberyl eyes and full lips both wide. "Just beyond weird. I know him. He invited Luli and me to the greatest hits launch last year. And I know your brothers, Al and Eddie. They told me they had a big brother in the army. God, mad. Is that you done, Bryony?"
Chiara added pointedly. The makeup artist seemed to be making a laborious business of gathering up the tools of her trade. Now she sped up perceptibly, while Chiara smoked and watched her in silence.
"Yep, that's me," said Bryony brightly at last, hoisting a heavy box over her shoulder and picking up more cases in each hand. "See you, Chiara. Goodbye," she added to Strike, and left.
"She is so bloody nosy and such a gossip," Chiara told Strike. She threw back her long white hair, rearranged her coltish legs, and asked,
"Do you see a lot of Al and Eddie?"
"No," said Strike.
"And your mum?"
she said, unfazed, blowing smoke out of the corner of her mouth.
"I mean, she's just like a legend. You know how Baz Carmichael did a whole collection 2 seasons back called Super Groupie, and it was like Bebe Buell and your mum were the whole inspiration. Maxi skirts and buttonless shirts and boots."
"I didn't," said Strike.
"Oh, it was like, you know that great quote about Ozzie Clark dresses, how men liked them because they could just, like, open them up really easily and fuck the girls? That's like your mum's whole era."
She shook her hair out of her eyes again and gazed at him, not with a chilling and offensive appraisal of Tansy Bestigui, but in what seemed to be frank and open wonder. It was difficult for him to decide whether she was sincere or performing her own character. Her beauty got in the way, like a thick cobweb through which it was difficult to see her clearly.
"So, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you about Lula."
"God, yeah. Yeah, no, I really want to help. When I heard someone was investigating it, I was like, well, good, at last."
"Really?"
"God, yeah. The whole thing was so fucking shocking. I just couldn't believe it. She's still on my phone. Look at this."
She rummaged in an enormous handbag, finally retrieving a white iPhone. Scrolling down the contact list, she leaned into him, showing him the name Luli. Her perfume was sweet and peppery.
"I keep expecting her to call me," said Chiara, momentarily subdued, slipping the phone back into her bag. I can't delete her. I keep going to do it and then just, like, bottling it, you know?
She raised herself restlessly, twisted one of the long legs underneath her, sat back down, and smoked in silence for a few seconds.
"You were with her most of her last day, weren't you?" Strike asked.
"Don't fucking remind me," said Kiara, closing her eyes. "I've only been over it, like, a million times. Trying to get my head around how you can go from, like, completely bloody happy to dead in, like, hours."
"She was completely happy."
"God, happier than I'd ever seen her that last week. We got back from a job in Antigua for Vogue, and she and Evan got back together, and they had the commitment ceremony. It was all fantastic for her. She was on cloud nine."
"You were at this commitment ceremony?"
"Oh, yeah," said Kiara,
dropping her cigarette end into a can of Coke, where it was extinguished with a small hiss.
"God, it was beyond romantic. Evan just, like, sprang it on her at Dickie Carberry's house. You know Dickie Carberry, the restaurateur? He's got this fabulous place in the Cotswolds, and we were all there for the weekend. And Evan had bought them both matching bangles from Fergus Keane, gorgeous, oxidized silver. He forced us all down to the lake after dinner in the freezing cold and the snow, and then he recited this poem he'd written to her, and put the bangle on her wrist."
Luli was laughing her head off, but then she just, like, recited a poem she knew back to him. "Walt Whitman, it was," said Kiara, with an air of sudden seriousness. "Honestly, like, so impressive. Just to have the perfect poem to say, just like that. People think models are dumb, you know."
She threw her hair back again and offered Strike a cigarette before taking another herself. "I get so bored of telling people I've got a deferred place to read English at Cambridge."
"Have you?" asked Strike, unable to suppress the surprise in his voice.
"Yeah," she said, blowing out smoke prettily. "But, you know, the modelling's going so well, I'm going to give it another year. It's opening doors, you know?"
"So this commitment ceremony was when? A week before Lula died?"
"Yeah," said Kiara. "The Saturday before."
"And it was just an exchange of poems and bangles? No vows? No officiant?"
"No, it wasn't legally binding or anything. It was just like this lovely, this perfect moment." "Well, except for Freddie Bastigui, he was being a bit of a pain. But at least..." Kiara drew hard on her cigarette. "His bloody wife wasn't there."
"Tansy?"
"Tansy Chillingham, yeah. She's a bitch. It's so not a surprise they're divorcing. They led, like, totally separate lives. You never saw them out together. To tell you the truth, Freddie wasn't too bad that weekend, seeing what a nasty rep he's got. He was just a bore, the way he kept trying to suck up to Luli. But he wasn't awful, like they say he can be. I heard a story about this, like, totally naive girl he promised a bit part in a film. But I don't know whether it was true."
Kiara squinted for a moment at the end of her cigarette. "She never reported it anyway."
"You said Freddie was being a pain. In what way?"
"Oh, God, he kept, like, cornering Luli and going on about how great she'd be on screen and, like, what a great bloke her dad was."
"Sir Alec?"
"Yeah, Sir Alec, of course." "Oh, my God," said Kiara wide-eyed. "If he'd known her real father, Luli would have, like, flipped out completely. That would have been, like, the dream of her life. No, he just said he'd known Sir Alec years and years ago, and they came from, like, the same East End manor or something. So he should be considered, like, her godfather or something. I think he was trying to be funny, but not. Anyway, everyone could tell he was just trying to work out how to get her into a film. He was a jerk about the commitment ceremony. He kept shouting, 'I'll give away the bride!' He was pissed. He drank like crazy all through dinner. Dickie had to shut him up. Then, after the ceremony, we all had champagne back at the house, and Freddie had, like, another two bottles on top of everything he'd already put away. He kept yelling at Luli that she'd make such a great actress, but she didn't care, she just ignored him. She was cuddled up with Evan on the sofa, just, like..." And suddenly, tears were sparkling in Kiara's cold eyes, and she squashed them out of sight
with the flat palms of her pretty white hands. Crazy in love. She was so fucking happy. I'd never seen her happier.
You met Freddy Bestigui again, didn't you? On the evening before Lula died. Didn't the two of you pass him in the lobby on your way out?
Yeah,
said Chiara, still dabbing at her eyes.
How did you know that?
Wilson, the security guard. He thought Bestigui said something to Lula that she didn't like.
Yeah, he's right. I'd forgotten about that. Freddy said something about D.B. Mack, about Luli being excited about him coming, how he really wanted to get them on film together. I can't remember exactly what it was, but he made it sound dirty, you know?
Did Lula know that Bestigui and her adoptive father had been friends?
She told me it was the first she'd ever heard of it. She always stayed out of Freddy's way at the flats. She didn't like Tansy.
Why not?
Oh, Luli wasn't interested in that whole, like, whose husband's got the biggest fucking yacht crap. She didn't want to get into their crowd. She was so much better than that. So not like the Chillingham girls.
Okay, said Strike. Can you talk me through the afternoon and evening you were with her? Chiara dropped her second fag end into the Coke can, with another little spitting fizz, and immediately lit another.
Yeah, okay, let me think. Well, I met her at her place in the afternoon. Bryony came over to do her eyebrows and ended up giving us both manicures. We just had, like, a girly afternoon together.
How did she seem?
She was...
Chiara hesitated.
Well, she wasn't quite as happy as she'd been that week. But not suicidal, I mean, no way.
Her driver, Kieran, thought she seemed strange when she left her mother's house in Chelsea.
Oh, God, yeah, well, why wouldn't she be? Her mum had cancer, didn't she?
Did Lula discuss her mother when she saw you?
No, not really. I mean, she said she'd just been sitting with her, because she was a bit, you know, pulled down after her op. But nobody thought then that Lady Bristow was going to die. The op was supposed to cure her, wasn't it?
Did Lula mention any other reason that she was feeling less happy than she had been?
No, said Chiara, slowly shaking her head, the white blonde hair tumbling around her face. She raked it back again and took a deep drag on her cigarette. She did seem a bit down, a bit distracted, but I just put it down to having seen her mum. They had a weird relationship. Lady Bristow was, like, really overprotective and possessive. Luli found it, you know, a bit claustrophobic.
Did you notice Lula telephoning anyone while she was with you?
No, said Chiara, after a thoughtful pause. I remember her checking her phone a lot, but she didn't speak to anyone, as far as I can remember. If she was phoning anyone, she was doing it on the quiet. She was in and out of the room a bit. I don't know.
Bryony thought she seemed excited about D.B. Mack.
Oh, for God's sake, said Chiara impatiently. It was everyone else who was excited about D.B. Mack. Guy and Bryony and... Well, even I was a bit, she said, with endearing honesty. But Luli wasn't that fussed. She was in love with Evan. You can't believe everything Bryony says.
Did Lula have a piece of paper with her, that you can remember, a bit of blue paper which she'd written on?
No, said Chiara again. Why, what was it?
I don't know yet, said Strike, and Chiara looked suddenly thunderstruck.
God, you're not telling me she left a note? Oh my God! How fucking mad would that be? But no, that would mean she'd have, like, already decided she was going to do it.
Maybe it was something else, said Strike. You mentioned at the inquest that Lula expressed an intention to leave everything to her brother, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right, said Chiara, earnestly nodding. Yeah, what happened was Guy had sent Lula these fabby handbags from the new range. I knew he wouldn't have sent me any, even though I was in the advert too. Anyway, I unwrapped the white one, Cashiel, you know, and it was just, like, beautiful. He does these detachable silk linings, and he'd had it custom printed for her with this amazing African print. So I said, Luli, will you leave me this one? Just as a joke. And she said, like, really seriously,
I'm leaving everything to my brother, but I'm sure he'd let you have anything you want.
Strike was watching and listening for any sign that she was lying or exaggerating, but the words came easily and, to all appearances, frankly.
That was a strange thing to say, wasn't it?
He asked.
Yes, I suppose, said Kiara, shaking the hair back off her face again. But Luli was like that. She could go a bit dark and dramatic sometimes. Guy used to say, less of the cuckoo, cuckoo. Anyway, Kiara sighed. She didn't take the hint about the Kashiel bag. I was hoping she'd just give it to me. I mean, she had four.
Would you say you were close to Lula?
Oh, God, yes, yeah, super close. She told me everything.
A couple of people have mentioned that she didn't trust too easily, that she was scared of confidences turning up in the press. I've been told that she tested people to see whether she could trust them.
Oh, yeah. She did get a bit, like, paranoid after her real mum started selling stories about her. She actually asked me, said Kiara, with an airy wave of her cigarette, whether I told anyone she was back with Evan. I mean, come on! There was no way she was going to keep that quiet. Everyone was talking about it. I said to her, Luli, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
That's Oscar Wilde, she added kindly. But Luli didn't like that side of being famous.
Guy Sommet thinks that Lula wouldn't have got back with Duffield if he hadn't been out of the country.
Kiara glanced towards the door and dropped her voice.
Guy would say that. He was just, like, super protective of Luli. He adored her. He really loved her. He thought Evan was bad for her. But honestly, he doesn't know the real Evan. Evan's, like, totally fucked up, but he's a good person. He went to see Lady Bristow not long ago, and I said to him, "Why, Evan? What on earth did you put yourself through that for?" Because, you know, her family hated him. And you know what he said? "I just want to speak to somebody who cares as much as I do that she's gone." I mean, how sad is that?
Strike cleared his throat.
"The press have totally got it in for Evan. It's just so unfair. He can't do anything right."
"Duffield came to your place, didn't he? The night she died."
"God, yeah, and there you are," said Kiara indignantly. "They made out we were, like, shagging or something. He had no money and his driver had disappeared, so he just, like, hiked across London so he could crash at mine. He slept on the sofa. So we were together when we heard the news."
She raised her cigarette to her full mouth and drew deeply on it, her eyes on the floor.
"It was terrible. You can't imagine. Terrible. Evan was, oh my God. And then," she said, in a voice barely louder than a whisper, "they were all saying it was him. After Tansy Chillingham said she'd heard a row. The press just went crazy. It was awful."
She looked up at Strike, holding her hair off her face. The harsh overhead light merely illuminated her perfect bone structure.
"You haven't met Evan, have you?"
"No."
"Do you want to? You could come with me now. He said he was going along to Uzi tonight."
"That'd be great."
"Fabby, hang on."
She jumped up and called through the open door.
"Guy, sweetie, can I wear this tonight? Go on, to Uzi."
Sommet entered the small room. He looked exhausted behind his glasses.
"All right. Make sure you're photographed. Wreck it and I'll sue your skinny white ass."
"I'm not going to wreck it. I'm taking Cormoran to meet Evan."
She stuffed her cigarettes away into her enormous bag, which appeared to hold her day clothes too, and hoisted it over her shoulder. In her heels, she was within an inch of the detective's height. Sommet looked up at Strike, his eyes narrowed.
"Make sure you give the little shit a hard time."
"Guy," said Kiara, pouting, "don't be horrible."
"And watch yourself, Master Rokeby," Sommet added, with his usual edge of spite. "Kiara's a terrible slut, aren't you, dear? And she's like me. She likes them big."
"Guy!"
said Kiara, in mock horror.
"Come on, Cormoran. I've got a driver outside."
Chapter 8 Strike, forewarned, was nowhere near as surprised to see Kieran Colovis-Jones as the driver was to see him. Colovis-Jones was holding open the left-hand passenger door, faintly lit by the car's interior light, but Strike spotted his momentary change of expression when he laid eyes on Kiara's companion.
"Evening," said Strike,
moving around the car to open his own door and get in beside Kiara.
"Kieran, you've met Cormoran, haven't you?"
said Kiara, buckling herself in. Her dress had ridden up to the very top of her long legs. Strike could not be absolutely certain that she was wearing anything beneath it. She had certainly been braless in the white jumpsuit.
"Hi, Kieran," said Strike.
The driver nodded at Strike in the rearview mirror, but did not speak. He had assumed a strictly professional demeanour that Strike doubted was habitual in the absence of detectives. The car pulled away from the curb. Kiara started rummaging again in her bag. She removed a perfume spray and squirted herself liberally in a wide circle around her face and shoulders. Then dabbed lip gloss over her lips, talking all the while.
"What am I going to need? Money. Cormoran, would you be a total darling and keep this in your pocket? I'm not going to take this massive thing in."
She handed him a crumpled wad of twenties.
"You're a sweetheart. Oh, and I'll need my phone. Have you got a pocket for my phone? God, this bag's a mess."
She dropped it on the car floor.
"When you said that it would have been the dream of Lula's life to find her real father."
"Oh, God, it would have been. She used to talk about that all the time. She got really excited when that bitch, her birth mother, told her he was African. Guy always said that was bullshit, but he hated the woman."
"He met Marlene Higson, did he?"
"Oh, no. He just hated the whole, like, idea of her. He could see how excited Luli got, and he just wanted to protect her from being disappointed."
So much protection, Strike thought, as the car turned a corner in the dark.
Had Lula been that fragile? The back of Colovis Jones's head was rigid, correct, his eyes flickering more often than was necessary to rest upon Strike's face. And then Luli thought she had a lead on him, her real father, but that went completely cold on her, dead end. Yeah, it was so sad. She really thought she'd found him, and then it all just fell through her fingers.
What lead was this?
It was something about where the college was, something her mother said. Luli thought she'd found the place it must have been, and she went to look at the records or something with this funny friend of hers called...
"Rochelle?" suggested Strike.
The Mercedes was now purring up Oxford Street.
"Yeah, Rochelle, that's right. Luli met her in rehab or something, poor little thing. Luli was, like, unbelievably sweet to her. Used to take her shopping and stuff. Anyway, they never found him, or it was the wrong place or something, I can't remember."
"Was she looking for a man called Aguiman?"
"I don't think she ever told me the name."
"Or Owusu?"
Kiara turned her beautiful light eyes upon him in astonishment.
"That's Guy's real name."
"I know."
"Oh, my God," Kiara giggled. "Guy's dad never went to college. He was a bus driver. He used to beat Guy up for sketching dresses all the time. That's why Guy changed his name."
The car was slowing down. The long queue, four people wide, stretching along the block, led to a discreet entrance that might have been to a private house. A gaggle of dark figures was gathered around a white pillared doorway.
"Paps," said Colovis Jones, speaking for the first time. "Careful how you get out of the car, Kiara."
He slid out of the driver's seat and walked around to the left-hand back door. But the paparazzi were already running, ominous, darkly clad men raising their long-nosed cameras as they closed in. Kiara and Strike emerged into flashes like gunfire. Strike's retinas were in sudden, dazzling whiteout. He ducked his head. His hand closed instinctively around Kiara Porter's slender upper arm, and he steered her ahead of him through the black oblong that represented sanctuary as the doors opened magically to admit them. The queuing hordes were shouting,
protesting at their easy entry, yelping with excitement. And then the flashes stopped, and they were inside, where there was an industrial roar of noises and a loud, insistent bass line.
"Wow! You've got a great sense of direction," said Kiara. "I usually, like, ricochet off the bouncers and they have to push me in."
Streaks and blazes of purple and yellow light were still burned across Strike's field of vision. He dropped her arm. She was so pale that she looked almost luminous in the gloom. Then they were jostled further inside the club by the entry of another dozen people behind them.
"Come on,"
said Kiara, and she slipped a soft, long-fingered hand inside his and tugged him along behind her. Faces turned as they walked through the packed crowd, both of them taller by far than the majority of clubbers. Strike could see what looked like long glass fish tanks set into the walls, containing what seemed to be great floating blobs of wax, reminding him of his mother's old lava lamps. There were long black leather banquettes along the walls, and further in, nearer the dance floor, booths. It was hard to tell how big the club was, because of judiciously placed mirrors. At one point, Strike caught a glimpse of himself head-on, looking like a sharply dressed heavy behind the silvery sylph that was Kiara. The music pounded through every part of him, vibrating through his head and body. The crowd on the dance floor was so dense that it seemed miraculous that they were managing even to stamp and sway. They had reached a padded doorway, guarded by a bald bouncer who grinned at Kiara, revealing two gold teeth, and pushed open the concealed entrance. They entered a quieter, though hardly less crowded bar area that was evidently reserved for the famous and their friends. Strike noticed a miniskirted television presenter, a soap actor, a comedian primarily famous for his sexual appetite, and then, in a distant corner, Evan Duffield. He was wearing a skull-patterned scarf wound around his neck and skin-tight black jeans, sitting at the join of two black leather banquettes with arms stretched at right angles along the backs of the benches on either side, where his companions, mostly women, were crammed. His dark shoulder-length hair had been dyed blonde. He was pallid and bony-faced, and the smudges around his bright turquoise eyes were dark purple. The group containing Duffield was emanating an almost magnetic force over the room. Strike saw it in the sneaking sidelong glances other occupants were shooting them, in the respectful space left around them, a wider orbit than anybody else had been granted. Duffield and his cohort's apparent unselfconsciousness was, Strike recognized, nothing but expert artifice. They had, all of them, the hyper-alertness of the prey animal combined with the casual arrogance of predators. In the inverted food chain of fame, it was the big beasts who were stalked and hunted. They were receiving their due. Duffield was talking to a sexy brunette. Her lips were parted as she listened, almost ludicrously immersed in him. As Kiara and Strike drew nearer, Strike saw Duffield glance away from the brunette for a fraction of a second, making, Strike thought, a lightning-fast recce of the bar, taking the measure of the room's attention and of other possibilities it might offer.
"Kiara!"
he yelled hoarsely. The brunette looked deflated as Duffield jumped nimbly to his feet. Thin and yet well-muscled, he slid out from behind the table to embrace Kiara, who was 8 inches taller than he in her platform shoes. She dropped Strike's hand to return the hug. The whole bar seemed, for a few shining moments, to be watching. Then they remembered themselves and returned to their chat and their cocktails.
"Evan, this is Cormoran Strike," said Kiara.
She moved her mouth close to Duffield's ear, and Strike saw rather than heard her say,
"He's Johnny Rokeby's son." "All right, mate?"
asked Duffield, holding out a hand, which Strike shook. Like other inveterate womanizers Strike had encountered, Duffield's voice and mannerisms were slightly camp. Perhaps such men became feminized by prolonged immersion in women's company,
or perhaps it was a way of disarming their quarry. Duffield indicated with a flutter of the hand that the others should move along the bench to make room for Chiara. The brunette looked crestfallen. Strike was left to find himself a low stool, drag it alongside the table, and ask Chiara what she wanted to drink.
"Ooh, get me a boozy oozy," she said, "and use my money, sweetie."
Her cocktail smelled strongly of Pernod. Strike bought himself water and returned to the table. Chiara and Duffield were now almost nose to nose, talking. But when Strike set down the drinks, Duffield looked around.
"So what'd you do, Cormoran? Music biz?"
"No," said Strike. "I'm a detective."
"No shit," said Duffield. "Who am I supposed to have killed this time?"
The group around him permitted themselves wry or nervous smiles, but Chiara said,
"Don't joke, Evan." "I'm not joking, Chiara. You'll notice when I am, because it'll be fucking funny."
The brunette giggled.
"I said I'm not joking," snapped Duffield.
The brunette looked as though she had been slapped. The rest of the group seemed imperceptibly to withdraw, even in the cramped space. They began their own conversation, temporarily excluding Chiara, Strike, and Duffield.
"Evan, not nice," said Chiara.
But her reproach seemed to caress rather than sting, and Strike noticed that the glance she threw the brunette held no pity. Duffield drummed his fingers on the edge of the table.
"So, what kind of a detective are you, Cormoran?"
"A private one."
"Evan, darling, Cormoran's been hired by Luli's brother." But Duffield had apparently spotted someone or something of interest up at the bar, for he leapt to his feet and disappeared into the crowd there. "He's always a bit ADHD," said Chiara apologetically. "Plus, he's still really, really fucked up about Luli."
"He is,"
she insisted, half cross, half amused, as Strike raised his eyebrows and looked pointedly in the direction of the voluptuous brunette, who was now cradling an empty mojito glass and looking morose. "You've got something on your smart jacket," Chiara added, and she leaned forwards to brush off what Strike thought were pizza crumbs. He caught a strong whiff of her sweet, spicy perfume. The silver material of her dress was so stiff that it gaped, like armour, away from her body, affording him an unhampered view of small white breasts and pointed, shell-pink nipples.
"What's that perfume you're wearing?"
She thrust a wrist under his nose.
"It's Guy's new one," she said. "It's called Éprise. It's French for smitten, you know?"
"Yeah," he said. Duffield had returned, holding another drink, cleaving his way back through the crowd, whose faces revolved after him, tugged by his aura. His legs in their tight jeans were like black pipe cleaners, and with his darkly smudged eyes, he looked like a Piero gone bad.
"Evan, babes," said Chiara, when Duffield had reseated himself. "Cormoran's investigating."
"He heard you the first time," Strike interrupted her. "There's no need."
He thought that the actor had heard that too. Duffield drank his drink quickly and tossed a few comments into the group beside them. Chiara sipped her cocktail, then nudged Duffield.
"How's the film going, sweetie?"
"Great. Well, suicidal drug dealer. It's not a stretch, you know?"
Everyone smiled, except Duffield himself. He drummed his fingers on the table, his legs jerking in time.
"Bored now,"
he announced. He was squinting towards the door, and the group was watching him, openly yearning, Strike thought, to be scooped up and taken along. Duffield looked from Chiara to Strike.
"Want to come back to mine?"
"Fabby!"
squeaked Chiara, and with a feline glance of triumph at the brunette, she downed her drink in one. Just outside the VIP area, two drunk girls ran at Duffield. One of them pulled up her top and begged him to sign her breasts.
"Don't be dirty, love,"
said Duffield, pushing past her.
"You got a car, Kiki?"
he yelled over his shoulder, as he ploughed his way through the crowds, ignoring shouts and pointing fingers.
"Yes, sweetie," she shouted. "I'll call him. Cormoran, darling, have you got my phone?
Strike wondered what the paparazzi outside would make of Kiara and Duffield leaving the club together. She was shouting into her iPhone. They reached the entrance. Kiara said,
"Wait, he's going to text when he's right outside."
Both she and Duffield looked slightly nervy, watchful, self-aware, like competitors waiting to enter a stadium. Then Kiara's phone gave a little buzz.
"Okay, he's there," she said.
Strike stood back to let her and Duffield out first, then walked rapidly to the front passenger seat as Duffield ran around the back of the car in the blinding popping lights, to screams from the queue, and threw himself into the back seat with Kiara, who Colovis Jones had helped inside. Strike slammed the front passenger door, forcing the two men who had leaned in to take shot after shot of Duffield and Kiara to jump backwards out of the way. Colovis Jones seemed to take an unconscionable amount of time to return to the car. Strike felt as though the Mercedes interior was a test tube, simultaneously enclosed and exposed, as more and more flashes fired. Lenses were pressed to the windows and windscreen. Unfriendly faces floated in the darkness, and black figures darted back and forth in front of the stationary car. Beyond the explosions of light, the shadowy crowd queue surged, curious and excited.
"Put your foot down for fuck's sake," Strike growled at Colovis Jones, who revved the engine. The paparazzi blocking the road moved backwards, still taking pictures.
"Bye-bye, you cunts,"
said Evan Duffield from the back seat as the car pulled away from the curb. But the photographers ran alongside the vehicle, flashes erupting on either side, and Strike's whole body was bathed in sweat. He was suddenly back on a yellow dirt road in the juddering Viking, with a sound like firecrackers popping in the Afghanistan air. He had glimpsed a youth running away from the road ahead, dragging a small boy. Without conscious thought, he had bellowed, "Break!" lunged forwards and seized Anstis, a new father of 2 days standing, who was sitting right behind the driver. The last thing he remembered was Anstis's shouted protest and the low metallic boom of him hitting the back doors, before the Viking disintegrated with an ear-splitting bang, and the world became a hazy blur of pain and terror. The Mercedes had rounded the corner onto an almost deserted road. Strike realized that he had been holding himself so tensely that his remaining calf muscles were sore. In the wing mirror, he could see two motorbikes, each being ridden pillion, following them. Princess Diana and the Parisian underpass. The ambulance bearing Lula Landry's body, with cameras held high to the darkened glass as it passed. Both careered through his thoughts as the car sped through the dark streets. Duffield lit a cigarette. Out of the corner of his eye, Strike saw Colovis Jones scowl at his passenger in the rearview mirror, though he made no protest. After a moment or two, Kiara began whispering to Duffield. Strike thought he heard his own name. 5 minutes later, they turned another corner and saw, ahead of them, another small crowd of black-clad photographers who began flashing and running towards the car the moment it appeared. The motorbikes were pulling up right behind them. Strike saw the four men running to catch the moment when the car doors opened. Adrenaline erupted. Strike imagined himself exploding out of the car, punching, sending expensive cameras crashing onto concrete as their holders crumpled. And as if he had read Strike's mind, Duffield said, with his hand poised on the door handle,
"Knock their fucking lights out, Cormoran, you're built for it."
The open doors, the night air, and more maddening flashes. Bull-like, Strike walked fast with his big head bowed, his eyes on Kiara's tottering heels, refusing to be blinded. Up three steps they ran, Strike at the rear, and it was he who slammed the front door of the building in the faces of the photographers. Strike felt himself momentarily allied with the other two by the experience of being hunted. The tiny, dimly lit lobby felt safe and friendly. The paparazzi were still yelling to each other on the other side of the door,
and their terse shouts recalled soldiers wreckying a building. Duffield was fiddling at an inner door, trying a succession of keys in the lock.
"I've only been here a couple of weeks," he explained,
finally opening it with a barging shoulder. Once over the threshold, he wriggled out of his tight jacket, threw it onto the floor by the door, and then led the way, his narrow hips swinging in only slightly less exaggerated fashion than Guy Sommet's, down a short corridor into a sitting room, where he switched on lamps. The spare, elegant grey and black decor had been overlaid by clutter and stank of cigarette smoke, cannabis, and alcohol fumes. Strike was reminded vividly of his childhood.
"Need a slash," announced Duffield,
and called over his shoulder as he disappeared, with a directive jab of the thumb.
"Drinks are in the kitchen, Kiki."
She threw a smile at Strike, then left through the door Duffield had indicated. Strike glanced around the room, which looked as though it had been left by parents of impeccable taste in the care of a teenager. Every surface was covered in debris, much of it in the form of scribbled notes. Three guitars stood propped against the walls. A cluttered glass coffee table was surrounded by black and white seats, angled towards an enormous plasma TV. Bits of debris had overflowed from the coffee table onto the black fur rug below. Beyond the long windows, with their gauzy grey curtains, Strike could make out the shapes of the photographers still prowling beneath the streetlight. Duffield had returned, tugging up his fly. On finding himself alone with Strike, he gave a nervous giggle.
"Make yourself at home, big fella. Hey, I know your old man, actually."
"Yeah?" said Strike, sitting down in one of the squashy pony-skin cube-shaped armchairs.
"Yeah, met him a couple of times," said Duffield. "Cool dude."
He picked up a guitar, began to pick out a twiddling tune on it, thought better of it, and put the instrument back against the wall. Chiara returned, carrying a bottle of wine and three glasses.
"Couldn't you get a cleaner, dearie?"
she asked Duffield reprovingly.
"They give up," said Duffield.
He vaulted over the back of a chair and landed with his legs sprawled over the side.
"No fucking stamina."
Strike pushed aside the mess on the coffee table so that Chiara could set down the bottle and glasses.
"I thought you'd moved in with Mo Innes," she said,
pouring out wine.
"Yeah, that didn't work out,"
said Duffield, raking through the detritus on the table for cigarettes.
"Old Freddy's rented me this place just for a month while I'm going out to Pinewood. He wants to keep me away from me old haunts."
His grubby fingers passed over a string of what seemed to be rosary beads. Numerous empty cigarette packets with bits of car torn out of them, three lighters, one of them an engraved Zippo, Rizzler papers, tangled leads unattached to appliances, a pack of cards, a sordid, stained handkerchief, sundry crumpled pieces of grubby paper, a music magazine featuring a picture of Duffield in moody black and white on the cover, opened and unopened mail, a pair of crumpled black leather gloves, a quantity of loose change and, in a clean china ashtray on the edge of the debris, a single cufflink in the form of a tiny silver gun. At last, he unearthed a soft packet of gitane from under the sofa, lit up, blew a long jet of smoke at the ceiling, then addressed Chiara, who had placed herself on the sofa at right angles to the two men, sipping her wine.
"They'll say we're fucking each other again, Key," he said,
pointing out of the window at the prowling shadows of the waiting photographers.
"And what'll they say Cormorant's here for?"
asked Chiara, with a sidelong glance at Strike.
"A threesome?"
"Security," said Duffield, appraising Strike through narrowed eyes. "He looks like a boxer or a cage fighter. Don't you want a proper drink, Cormoran?"
"No, thanks," said Strike.
"What's that, AA or being on duty?"
"Duty." Duffield raised his eyebrows and sniggered. He seemed nervous, shooting Strike darting looks, drumming his fingers on the glass table. When Chiara asked him whether he had visited Lady Bristow again, He seemed relieved to be offered a subject.
Fuck no. Once was enough. It was fucking horrible. Poor bitch, on her fucking deathbed.
It was beyond nice of you to go, though, Evan. Strike knew that she was trying to show Duffield off in his best light.
Do you know Lula's mother well?
He asked Duffield.
No. I only met her once before Lou died. She didn't approve of me. None of Lou's family approved of me. I don't know,
he fidgeted.
I just wanted to talk to someone who really gives a shit that she's dead.
Evan, Kiara pouted. I care she's dead, excuse me.
Yeah, well.
With one of his oddly feminine fluid movements, Duffield curled up in the chair so that he was almost fetal and sucked hard on his cigarette. On a table behind his head, illuminated by a cone of lamplight, was a large stagey photograph of him with Lula Landry, clearly taken from a fashion shoot. They were mock wrestling against a backdrop of fake trees. She was wearing a floor-length red dress, and he was in a slim black suit, with a hairy wolf's mask pushed up on top of his forehead.
I wonder what my mum would say if I copped it. My parents got an injunction out against me,
Duffield informed Strike.
Well, it was mainly my fucking father, because I nicked their telly a couple of years ago. Do you know what?
He added, craning his neck to look at Kiara.
I've been clean 5 weeks, 2 days.
That's so fabulous, baby. That's fantastic.
Yeah,
he said. He swiveled upright again.
Aren't you going to ask me any questions?
He demanded of Strike.
I thought you were investigating Lou's murder.
The bravado was undermined by the tremor in his fingers. His knees began bouncing up and down, just like John Bristow's.
"Do you think it was murder?"
Strike asked.
"No."
Duffield dragged on his cigarette.
"Yeah, maybe, I don't know. Murder makes more sense than fucking suicide, anyway. Because she wouldn't have gone without leaving me a note. I keep waiting for a note to turn up, you know, and then I'll know it's real. It don't feel real. I can't even remember the funeral. I was out of my fucking head. I took so much stuff I couldn't fucking walk. I think if I could just remember the funeral, it'd be easier to get me head round.
He jammed his cigarette between his lips and began drumming with his fingers on the edge of the glass table. After a while, apparently discomforted by Strike's silent observation, he demanded,
"Ask me something, then. Who's hired you, anyway?"
Lula's brother, John. Duffield stopped drumming.
That money-grabbing poker-ass wanker.
Money-grabbing?
He was fucking obsessed with how she spent her fucking money, like it was any of his fucking business. Rich people always think everyone else is a fucking freeloader. Have you noticed that? Her whole frigging family thought I was gold-digging, and after a bit...
He raised a finger to his temple and made a boring motion.
It went in. It planted doubts, you know?
He snatched one of the Zippos from the table and began flicking at it, trying to make it ignite. Strike watched tiny blue sparks erupt and die as Duffield talked.
I expect he thought she'd be better off with some rich fucking accountant like him.
He's a lawyer.
Whatever. What's the difference? It's all about helping rich people keep their mitts on as much money as they can, innit? He's got his fucking trust fund from Daddy. What skin is it off his nose what his sister did with her own money?
What was it that he objected to her buying, specifically?
Shit for me. The whole fucking family was the same. They didn't mind if she chucked it their way, keep it in the fucking family, that was okay. Lou knew they were a mercenary load of fuckers, but like I say, it still left his fucking mark, planted ideas in her head.
He threw the dead Zippo back onto the table, drew his knees up to his chest, and glared at Strike with his disconcerting turquoise eyes.
So he still thinks I did it, does he, your client?
No, I don't think he does, said Strike.
He's changed his narrow, fuck-witted mind, then, because I heard he was going round telling everyone it was me before they ruled it as suicide. Only I've got a cast-iron fucking alibi, so fuck him. Fuck them. Oh.
Restless and nervous, he got to his feet, added wine to his almost untouched glass, then lit another cigarette.
"What can you tell me about the day Lula died?" Strike asked.
"The night, you mean?"
"But the day leading up to it might be quite important, too. There are a few things I'd like to clear up."
"Yeah? Go on, then."
Duffield dropped back down into the chair and pulled his knees up to his chest again. "Lula called you repeatedly between around midday and 6 in the evening, but you didn't answer your phone."
"No,"
said Duffield. He began picking childishly at a small hole in the knee of his jeans.
"Well, I was busy. I was working on a song. Didn't want to stem the flow, the old inspiration."
"So you didn't know she was calling you?"
"Well, yeah, I saw her number coming up."
He rubbed his nose, stretched his legs out onto the glass table, folded his arms and said,
"I felt like teaching her a little lesson. Let her wonder what I was up to."
"Why did you think she needed a lesson?"
"That fucking rapper. I wanted her to move in with me while he was staying in the building. Don't be silly, don't you trust me?"
His imitation of Lula's voice and expression was disingenuously girlish.
"I said to her, don't you be fucking silly. Show me I've got nothing to worry about and come and stay with me. But she wouldn't. So then I thought, two can play at that fucking game, darling. Let's see how you like it. So I got Ellie Carrera over to my place and we did a bit of writing together. And then I brought Ellie along to Uzi with me. Lou couldn't fucking complain. Just business, just songwriting, just friends. Like her and that rapper gangster."
"I didn't think she'd ever met D.B. Mack."
"She hadn't. But he'd made his intentions pretty fucking public, hadn't he? Have you heard that song he wrote? She was creaming her panties over it."
"Bitch, you ain't all that," Kiara began to quote obligingly, but a filthy look from Duffield silenced her. "Did she leave you voicemail messages?"
"Yeah, a couple. Evan, will you call me, please? It's urgent. I don't want to say it on the phone." It was always fucking urgent when she wanted to find out what I was up to. She knew I was pissed off. She was worried I might have called Ellie. She had a real hang-up about Ellie, because she knew we'd fucked.
"She said it was urgent, and that she didn't want to say it on the phone."
"Yeah, but that was just to try and make me cool. One of her little games. She could be fucking jealous, Lou, and pretty fucking manipulative."
"Can you think why she'd be calling her uncle repeatedly that day as well?"
"What uncle?"
"His name's Tony Landry. He's another lawyer."
"Him? She wouldn't be calling him. She fucking hated him worse than her brother."
"She called him repeatedly over the same period that she was calling you, leaving more or less the same message."
Duffield raked his unshaven chin with dirty nails, staring at Strike.
"I don't know what that was about. Her mum, maybe. Old Lady B going into hospital or something."
"You don't think something might have happened that morning which she thought was either relevant to or of interest to both you and her uncle?"
"There isn't any subject that could interest me and her fucking uncle at the same time," said Duffield. "I've met him. Share prices and shit are all he'd be interested in."
"Maybe it was something about her, something personal."
"If it was, she wouldn't call that fucker. They didn't like each other."
"What makes you say that?"
"She felt about him like I feel about my fucking father. Neither of them thought we were worth shit."
"Did she talk to you about that?"
"Oh, yeah. He thought her mental problems were just attention-seeking, bad behaviour, put on, burden on her mother. He got a bit smarmier when she started making money, but she didn't forget."
"And she didn't tell you why she'd been calling you once she got to Uzi?"
"Nope,"
said Duffield. He lit another cigarette.
"She was fucked off from the moment she arrived because Ellie was there. Didn't like that at all. In a right fucking mood, wasn't she?"
For the first time, he appealed to Kiara, who nodded sadly.
"She didn't really talk to me," said Duffield. "She was mostly talking to you, wasn't she?"
"Yes," said Kiara. "And she didn't tell me there was anything, like, upsetting her or anything."
"A couple of people have told me her phone was hacked," began Strike.
Duffield talked over him.